Southern Fraud True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. In the early morning hours of July 5th, 2004, a man placed a desperate 911 call from the Robins Air Force Base in Georgia. The call only lasted 34 seconds, and the dispatcher could hear a man being attacked in the background, pleading for his life, and then a woman screaming. And then the line went dead. Andy and Jamie Schlipsick were found dead in their home, viciously stabbed to death with an Army combat knife. Their friend, Jason King, had been there too and was also severely injured, but managed to make it out the door, running to the first neighbor for help. Jason King survived, but just barely, and senior airman Andrew Paul Witt was arrested for the double murder and attempted murder the next day. So what led up to the events of this fateful night? Before this, over the 4th of July holiday, Andrew Witt, the Schlipsicks, and Jason King and his wife were all seemingly friends. Welcome to Episode 65, Double Murder on Robins Air Force Base. In October of 1941, the War Department was looking for a site for an Army Air Corps depot. They found a small town called Wellston, Georgia, just 18 miles south of Macon. It was a tiny whistle-stop town, made up of just farmers and their families, with the only landmark being the stop on the railroad line. Colonel Charles Thomas, who hailed from Atlanta, was tasked with overseeing the building of the depot. It was originally named Wellston Air Depot at Robins Field. Colonel Thomas had named the field for his mentor, Brigadier General Augustine Warner Robins, who was considered the father of logistics because he came up with an ingenious system for cataloging materials and supplies for the Army. But Thomas wasn't technically allowed to do this. Regulations required a base to be named after the nearest town. So in 1942, the town of Wellston was officially renamed Warner Robins, and the newly built depot took over the workload of two closed Air Force bases in Mobile, Alabama, and Middleton Township, Pennsylvania. Robins Air Force Base is not within the city limits of Warner Robins, but just across U.S. Highway 129 that serves as a boundary between the base and the city. Today, Warner Robins has about 75,000 residents and is home to the Museum of Aviation, the largest tourist attraction outside of Atlanta in the state of Georgia. Warner Robins is located in Houston County, in the middle of the state, with hot and humid summers but pretty mild winters. In 2004, when today's story takes place, there were around 50,000 residents in the town of Warner Robins, and Robins Air Force Base employed around 25,000 civilians, contractors, and military members. The residential population on base was around 1,000. And on the 4th of July holiday in 2004, temperatures ranged in the mid-90s. When it's hot and sticky, and especially on a national holiday, people drink more, make bad decisions, and tempers flare. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Andy and Jamie Schlipsick had been high school sweethearts. Jamie was more shy and reserved, while Andy was charismatic and outgoing. As Jamie's father put it, they completed each other. Andrew Richard Schlipsick, known as Andy, was born in Peoria, Illinois, on April 3, 1979, to parents Dave and Jacqueline. He had two brothers named Jeremy and Chad. He attended Richwoods High School, where he was a popular and athletic student, and he graduated in 1997. Jamie Lynn Bielenberg Schlipsick was born on July 19, 1979, also in Peoria, to parents Jim and Deborah. She had two sisters named Jody and Casey. Jamie also attended Richwoods High School, but only for 3 years, and then she attended University High School for her senior year. She was on the swim team and graduated in 1998. Her teachers thought she was a pleasant girl with a good attitude, just an all-around good kid. After high school, Jamie went to Eastern Illinois University, where she graduated in 2002. Andy enlisted in the Air Force in August of 2000. By 2004, he was a senior airman in the 54th Combat Communications Squadron of the Air Force. His job was to maintain ground radar equipment. He was deployed in Iraq from April to October of 2003. His commander, Colonel John Lent, described Andy as an outstanding troop and a natural leader. Andy moved to Robins Air Force Base in 2001, shortly before he and Jamie got married. Jamie worked as a social worker for Houston County, Georgia, once she joined him on base. The couple married back in their hometown of Peoria on June 8, 2002. Friends and neighbors characterized them as lovebirds. They never lost that initial giddy spark of falling in love. On the base, they lived in a red brick duplex, common to married couples, close to the other families on base. There they met Jason and Paige King. Jason King was a senior airman in the 53rd Squadron. He and Paige had a 3-year-old daughter named Ramsey. The couple lived about a quarter mile from each other. Andy and Jason were both senior airmen and worked in neighboring units. One of their colleagues suggested that they play a round of golf together, and the men became fast friends. So did Jamie and Paige. They shopped and hung out at the pool on base together. Paige had initially struggled to make friends on base and was delighted to find Jamie. By the summer of 2004, the couples were inseparable. Jason King later said he felt that he had known Andy his whole life. So he was really happy when Paige met Jamie and they also instantly clicked. The 4th of July holiday fell on a Sunday that year. On Saturday, the Kings hosted a get-together. Andy and Jamie brought a friend of Andy's along named Andrew Witt. They worked together, and when Jason met him, he was friendly and inviting, saying, "Any friend of Andy's is a friend of mine." The next day, Sunday, was officially Independence Day. It is usually a big party atmosphere on military bases. But the Schlipsicks and Kings just hung out together at Jason and Paige's place. They drank beer, grilled some ribs, and just hung out, as little Ramsey colored on the sidewalk with chalk. It was a fun, relaxed day. Andy had made the decision to leave the Air Force, and he and Paige were set to move to Chicago in 2 weeks, on to a new adventure. Jason and Paige were sad to see their friends leave, but they were already making plans to visit. As the evening was winding down, the couples considered going to the fireworks show, but decided to stay home. Paige, tired, said goodnight to everyone around midnight. Andy, Jamie, and Jason stayed up talking. Jamie had something bothering her, and she hadn't said anything to Andy about it yet. But after a few beers, and maybe feeling more comfortable, she decided to open up and tell him and Jason what was wrong. After the Saturday party at the King's home, Andrew Witt, the friend Andy and Jamie had brought, had too much to drink and rode home with the Schlipsicks to sleep on their couch. Andy went straight to bed, and Paige was making sure Andrew was set up in the living room when he made a pass at her. He tried to kiss her. Jamie said she firmly pushed him away and said no, and then went to bed. Andrew went to sleep on the couch, and he got up and left the next morning before Jamie and Andy woke up. Andy Schlipsick was understandably livid when he heard the story. Andrew Witt was his friend. He had trusted him in his home. He decided to call him and confront him. At 1:37 a.m., Andy called Andrew the first time. The next call was at 2:21 a.m., and it lasted for 33 minutes. But it was the last call where the men actually spoke. At this point, there were 2 calls between the 2 men and 9 unanswered calls. Jason later said he remembered a lot of calls back and forth, and then they just let the subject drop. I'm sure Jamie was relieved. It's not easy for a woman in this situation. She had to know it would upset her husband, but she probably felt very burdened by what happened and needed to get it out. And she felt comfortable with Jason there as well. Any woman who has spurned an unwanted sexual advance knows how awful it feels. It's much worse when it's someone you trust, someone you consider a friend. It's a betrayal, and it's embarrassing, even though you know you've done nothing wrong. Having let the uncomfortable subject of Andrew Witt drop, but not ready to call it a night, around 3:30 a.m., Andy, Jamie, and Jason drove to the Schlipsicks. They had run out of beer and cigarettes and figured they would go restock at Andy and Jamie's house. Meanwhile, Andrew Witt, back at his own apartment, had changed into his camouflaged combat uniform and grabbed a combat knife from his closet. He put the knife in the trunk of his car and then drove to the base at around 3:15 a.m. He parked 50 yards away from Jason's house so he could watch everyone without being seen. Crouching outside, he watched them through the trees and bushes. Later, from phone records, investigators found that once Andrew Witt was on base, he kept calling Jason and Andy. But this time, Andy wouldn't answer, and he talked to Jason. Jason said he did seem apologetic in some of the calls. But in other calls, Andrew reportedly told Jason that he and Andy should, quote, come over here and kick my ass. To which Jason responded with, you need your ass kicked. Andrew Witt watched Andy, Jamie, and Jason get in Andy's car and head to the Schlipsick house around 3:30 a.m. He left his car parked where it was and followed them on foot. When they all got to the house, Andy went into the kitchen and Jamie went into the bedroom to get a sweater. Jamie had called Paige to let her know where they all were, so Jason had followed her into the bedroom. And then they heard yelling in the kitchen. Andy was screaming, "Get out!" When Jason ran into the kitchen, he said he saw Andrew Witt in combat fatigues and figured he was there to fight. When Andrew Witt saw Jason King, he said, quote, oh good, you're here too. Jason tried to pull Andrew off of Andy by putting him in a headlock, but then Jason pulled the combat knife out of his pocket. Andrew broke free and ran to the living room with Andy and Jason close behind. Jason later said what happened next was so fast he could barely understand what was happening. Andrew and Andy were fighting while Jason was trying to pull Andrew away. And then Andrew turned around and seemingly punched Jason in the stomach. Only it wasn't a punch. Jason felt a searing pain in his stomach and realized Andrew had stabbed him. As Jason backed up into the kitchen, Jamie ran in screaming, "My God, you're bleeding." And then Andrew turned the knife onto Andy and he fell to the floor. Jamie kept screaming and ran back to the bedroom and locked herself in. Jason was trying to get out the kitchen door, but was struggling with the deadbolt. Andrew Witt came up behind him and kept stabbing him in the back. Jason finally made it out the kitchen door and staggered to the nearest neighbor who had a light on. The neighbor called 911 as Jason collapsed in their driveway. Andrew Witt later claimed he didn't want to leave any evidence, so he went back into the Schlipsick home after he at first tried to chase Jason to the neighbor's house. When he got back in the house, he found Andy on the phone with 911. This was the call that only lasted 34 seconds. Andy can be heard pleading for his own life and begging Andrew not to hurt Jamie. Andrew stabbed Andy twice more, and Andy died almost instantly. Andrew Witt then went to the bedroom and broke down the door. He later said Jamie was on the ground in the fetal position. He broke her arm, yanking her up, and then he stabbed her and kept stabbing her. After he killed Andy and Jamie, Andrew Witt left and returned to his apartment off base. His roommate later said Andy woke him up and they drove around for a while. Police arrived at the Schlipsick home and found the bodies of Andy and Jamie. They found Andy lying on his back in the living room with his open cell phone laying nearby. He had suffered 3 stab wounds. The first was to the left of his chest, penetrating his diaphragm and piercing his liver. The second stab wound severed his spinal cord and he was instantly paralyzed from the waist down. The third wound was to his chest, piercing straight through his heart and killed him instantly. Jamie was found slumped against the wall behind the bedroom door. She was wearing only a shirt and underwear. Her jean skirt was about 10 feet away from her body. A blood spatter expert would later say he believed the skirt was on Jamie before the attack and came off or was pulled off sometime during the attack. Jamie had suffered 5 stab wounds, 4 to her back. She had been stabbed once in her chest, collapsing her left lung and piercing her spleen. The stabs to her back went through her side, into her kidney and liver, and also collapsed her right lung. The final stab wound was under her right armpit, and it entered her chest cavity. Jamie also had what is called an incised wound to her back that cut into her 6th, 7th, and 8th ribs. An incision like that is slow and precise and makes you wonder if Andrew Witt deliberately cut Jamie that way to further terrorize her. With her skirt found away from her body, it looked as though Andrew was attempting to rape Jamie. Her autopsy showed Jamie wasn't raped, but you can only imagine her terror anyway. stabbed and about to be sexually assaulted, knowing her husband was dead or dying in the next room. But then Andrew Witt ran off into the darkness when he heard the sirens coming. Jason King had been stabbed 4 times, once in fighting with Andrew Witt, 3 more stabs to his back as he was trying to escape out the back door. That searing pain in his stomach that he had initially thought was a punch was actually angled up and punctured his left lung, nearly going through his entire chest cavity, almost severing a major artery. He had serious wounds to his spleen and kidney, as well as a laceration on his arm. He was rushed to the hospital where he underwent emergency surgery. He had lost 4.5 liters of blood and was in the hospital for 15 days. It was a miracle he survived. 2 weeks after his release, his lung collapsed again, and he got a staph infection. Jason later had 5 follow-up surgeries, spending over 30 more days in the hospital. He later told reporter Kristen Davis of the Air Force Times that every day when his wife Paige came to his hospital room, he asked about Andy and Jamie, and she just kept telling him that they can't be here right now. He finally began to understand, and on the 3rd or 4th day in the hospital, he said to Paige, "They're dead, aren't they?" She admitted they were, and an Air Force chaplain came to see Jason soon after. His commanding officer and first sergeant, as well as other airmen and friends, visited him frequently, but Jason was bereft. Just 2 weeks before the attack at the Schlipsic home, he had lost his best friend and wife in a car accident. And now, he had not only almost died from this horrific attack, he was grieving for 2 more lost friends. Jason begged his doctors to attend the funerals and also the memorial service held on base for Andy. But he was still in intensive care, and it just wasn't possible. The memorial service on base was on July 9th. The joint funeral for the Schlipsics was held in the same church, First Federated Church in Peoria, Illinois, where Andy and Jamie were married in 2002. Only 1 coffin, draped with an American flag, was in the church. Andy's body was in the coffin, and cradled in his arms was the urn holding the ashes of his wife. The murders of Andy and Jamie were the first murders committed on the Robins Air Force Base in its 75-year history. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from our sponsors. Native deodorant is formulated without aluminum, parabens, or talc. Instead, Native uses ingredients found in nature, like coconut oil, shea butter, and tapioca starch, and they do not test on animals. Native is creating safe, simple, and effective deodorant for everyday use that is shipped right to your door. And it really works. You can count on Native for your busy life, even your workouts. Check out the 8,000 5-star ratings from Native customers. If you subscribe to Native, you'll save 17%. That's $2 a stick, and Native will be conveniently delivered to your door as often as you choose. And there is no risk to try it. Native offers free returns and exchanges. Native comes in a wide variety of scents for men and women, as well as unscented and baking soda-free formulas for those with sensitivities. There are several scents to choose from, with classics being lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, coconut and vanilla, and eucalyptus and mint. I tried the eucalyptus and mint, and the first thing I noticed is that it went on clear. No streaking on my clothes. Also, the scent was great, but not overwhelming, not even when I sweat. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use the promo code SOUTHERNFRIED during checkout. That's nativedeodorant.com and then use the promo code SOUTHERNFRIED during checkout to get 20% off your first purchase. Are you looking for a new career or maybe just some extra cash? U.S. Career Institute has a program for you. For over 35 years, they've helped people prepare for job opportunities in the growing healthcare industry where you can legitimately work from home doing medical coding and billing. Basically, you would create medical reports for doctors, but you could still be your own boss and choose your own hours. And the best part is you learn at your own pace, online, in as little as 4 months. Study at home or anywhere, day or night. And U.S. Career Institute is not preparing you for a sales position. There is no monetary risk of business overhead, employees, or customers. If your goal is to secure a rewarding career in the growing healthcare industry, U.S. Career Institute could be perfect for you. U.S. Career Institute is accredited by the DEAC, has affordable tuition, and an A+ rating from the Better Business Bureau. So you get the freedom to study anytime, anywhere, online, and be ready to work in as little as 4 months with no previous medical experience necessary. Don't just take take my word for it. Go check out the facts now. Visit workfordoctors.com/southernfried. And then to get 25% off tuition, enroll with code SOUTHERNFRIED by Monday, October 7th. Some exclusions apply, so visit workfordoctors.com/southernfried for more detail. Andrew Witt was arrested July 5th, 2004, by the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, also called the AFOSI for short. He was held at the Houston County Jail. So who was this guy that wrought so much destruction on a beautiful young couple and their friend? Before the murders, Andrew Witt had no criminal history. He was not married and had no children. Andrew Paul Witt was born in June of 1982. When he was 3 years old, his parents Terry and Melanie divorced, and Melanie moved Andrew to Wichita shortly after. Andrew saw his dad on school breaks, and Melanie said his dad never missed a child support payment. Melanie remarried a doctor in 1988 and moved to Wisconsin, having two more children, and became a stay-at-home mom. Andrew's upbringing has been characterized as strongly religious, with his parents being strict and overprotective. But both of his parents described their son as a joy to raise, a happy and polite young man with no history of violence. But his life wasn't without some strife. Andrew's dad, Terry, had always struggled with drug and alcohol issues, and when Andrew was around 10 years old, Melanie and Terry agreed that it was best if he didn't see his dad until Terry got clean. So Andrew didn't see his dad again until he was 12 years old. By then, Terry had remarried, and Andrew didn't particularly care for his new stepmom or her kids. Melanie, Andrew's mother, voluntarily checked herself into a mental health facility in 1996 to deal with depression and stress. Andrew would have been about 14 years old at the time. As far as his education, he was homeschooled in the 7th and 8th grade. There is no reason given as to why, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything, but I am curious. Those would have been the turbulent years when he didn't see his father and his mom was dealing with depression. But Melanie was also a devout Christian. It's possible she didn't find public schools or a private school to her liking in those years. Andrew then attended a private Christian school in West Salem for his freshman year before he moved to Aquinas High School in La Crosse, Wisconsin. His teachers remember a friendly kid who played many sports but was also in jazz band. After he graduated, he spent 9 months in England at Capon Ray Bible School. His parents paid that tuition, and when he came home, his father gave him $30,000, which would be around $43,000 today, to either go to college or begin his adult life. In November of 2001, Andrew joined the United States Air Force. His dream was to become a pilot and then an astronaut. At the time of the murders, he was a senior airman and an avionics technician for the 116th Air Control Wing. But close friends and his family felt that joining the Air Force changed Andrew. He seemed like a different person when he came home for a visit in December of 2003. He now cursed all the time, something his evangelical parents would abhor, and he bragged a lot about partying and having many girlfriends. It seems to me he found a freedom on his own in the Air Force that he didn't find growing up. That's not unusual in any young person. And a lot of us were assholes in college, and technically, these were Andrew's college years. Something that is notable, though, is that on February 22, 2004, Andrew was riding his motorcycle when he lost control on a patch of gravel and wrecked just a couple of blocks from his apartment. He did lose consciousness for a little while, but then he got back on the motorcycle and drove to work. It was a coworker who noticed that Andrew had a cut over his left eye and that he seemed disheveled and disoriented. She said he was speaking slowly, almost slurring, and walking slowly, so she insisted he go see a doctor. He went to the hospital and was briefly admitted for a closed head injury, but was released the same day. We are starting to learn a lot more about traumatic brain injuries and how they can cause aggressive, even murderous behavior. You hear a lot about it in relation to football players. Long-term concussive injuries can even lead to dementia in later years. This will be a sticking point in the legal proceedings against Andrew. Once Andrew Witt was arrested, he had basically the same rights as a civilian. The right to remain silent, warrants for search and seizure of his property, and the right to an attorney. But in the military, typically, a military attorney would be appointed, at no cost to the defendant. However, you can hire a civilian attorney with your own money if you choose. The main difference in civilian and military arrests like these is that military personnel are not eligible for bail. Andrew Witt was eventually assigned 2 military attorneys and hired 1 civilian attorney to represent him. The civilian attorney had experience defending military cases, but had no capital trial experience. On July 8th, 3 days after the murders, Andrew's squadron commander charged him with 2 counts of premeditated murder and 1 count of premeditated attempted murder. And according to military law, charges must be brought within 120 days. Meaning, though military members are denied bail, they couldn't just hold Andrew Witt indefinitely while they investigated. Once Andrew was officially charged, the prosecution and his defense began their formal investigations. At some point in the investigation, which is unclear from court records, Andrew Witt did confess to the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. He said he wore his battle dress uniform, the camouflage combat fatigues, because he, quote, wanted to observe them unseen to see what was going on. He also said Andy was yelling at him during the calls. I'm sure he was. You tried to kiss his wife in his own house. Moving on. Andrew took the AFOSI investigators to where he disposed of the knife, the combat fatigues, and the cap and boots he was wearing that night. DNA from the bloodstains found on the boots and fatigues was tested and found to match Jamie's DNA. Trace evidence of red fibers from the knife was tested and was found to match fibers from the shirts Andy and Jason were wearing. The combat knife had a 6.5-inch serrated blade with a 6-inch handle. The AFOSI interviewed Andy's roommate, who told them that he also got a voicemail from Andy Schlipsik early in the morning of July 5th, telling him that Andrew had made a pass at his wife. Andy wanted the roommate to call him to talk about it. The roommate did not return his call. Andrew had told his roommate that he was going to wear his combat fatigues because he didn't want to be seen. Andrew also told his roommate that Andy had threatened to get him in trouble by telling their superiors about the advances he made toward Jamie and an affair he was having. Making a pass at another airman's wife was bad enough, but the second part, about Andrew having an affair with a married woman, was much more serious. When Andrew had been home at Christmas, one of the conquests he bragged about was an older married woman with a 17-year-old daughter. He also had designs on the daughter, laughing about how cool it would be to sleep with a mother and daughter. This is probably the affair discussed in court documents, but the other woman was not named. But the reason this is so serious is, according to military law, if you are charged with adultery, you can receive a disciplinary action all the way up to a court-martial or dishonorable discharge. Regardless of his anger over the confrontations about Jamie that fateful night, Andrew Witt would also have been worried about losing his career in the military if Andy Schlipsik turned him in for the affair. And though the roommate wasn't personally responsible and obviously cooperated later with authorities, you have to wonder if he really thought his friend was just going over to watch those couples, or if he was going to pick a fight. I would hope he did not know about the combat knife Andrew took with him, but that answer is not in the court records. At his first pretrial hearing, Andrew saw crime scene evidence for the first time during the hearing and became extremely upset. He was crying and had to leave the courtroom to calm down. A deputy sheriff consoled Andrew after he left the hearing, and Andrew did not return to the proceeding that day. In October of 2004, Andrew met with a forensic psychologist to prepare for trial. They met over 2 days for a total of 12 to 14 hours. During their meetings, the doctor gave Andrew a series of psychological tests, including neuropsychological, intellectual, and personality tests. They met again twice in June 2005 and once in September 2005. As of September 17, 2005, the doctor, named as Dr. B.M. in court records, did not have a psychological diagnosis of Andrew. But after the trial began, Dr. B.M. made the diagnosis. He testified that Andrew had a personality disorder not otherwise specified, with paranoid and borderline traits. After this, Dr. B.M. would meet with Andrew's defense team and would talk with them about his findings. But even after the doctor learned about Andrew's mother's mental health facility stay, he never advised his attorneys that they should get her mental health records to use in Andrew's defense. After learning about Andrew's motorcycle accident, the defense talked to Dr. B.M. about the possibility of a traumatic brain injury that could have caused Andrew's actions that night. But Dr. B.M. insisted there was no connection between the motorcycle accident and the murders, so therefore there would be no reason to conduct further neuropsychological testing. Nothing else was done to see if Andrew had a traumatic brain injury. A psychologist, referred to as Dr. A.M. in court documents, conducted the sanity board hearing and agreed with Dr. B.M. that there was no connection. But he did order the original CT scans of Andrew's brain first. A sanity board hearing is meant to determine if a defendant is mentally fit to stand trial. Dr. A.M. examined Andrew's CT scan from the accident and said, quote, "A medical record review indicates that the CT scan of the brain was negative for any significant changes." Meaning, despite the motorcycle accident, both the forensic psychologist who examined Andrew and the sanity board psychologist agreed that his head injury was not a factor. Andrew Witt was tried by general court-martial starting on September 13, 2005. According to Military.com, military court-martials are the most severe sanctions under military law, and a conviction is the same as a federal conviction. There are three levels of court-martial: summary, special, and general. The level of court-martial depends on the severity of the offense. General court-martials are the most severe of the three levels. A general court-martial can only be convened by a high-ranking official. Anyone from the president to a secretary of a military branch, a general, or a commander can convene a general court-martial. For capital offenses, the jury panel consists of 12 officers, and the general court-martial can impose any sentence up to and including death. Andrew Witt's trial was held at the Bibb County Courthouse in Macon, Georgia, because the Robins Air Force Base courtroom was too small to hold all the victims' family members. Even though the Bibb County Courthouse was bigger with more than 200 seats, it was still standing room only at Andrew's court-martial. There were over 430 exhibits and 60 witnesses. Because Andrew had already confessed to the murders and attempted murder of Jason King, the court-martial was determined whether the attacks were premeditated. In order to prove premeditation, the government primarily focused on Andrew's lack of remorse and callousness, as well as many victim impact statements from the family and friends of Andy and Jamie. Their case was basically that Andrew Witt was an evil man, with the additional motive that he didn't want Andy Schlipsick to tell his superiors about his affair or his advances towards Jamie Schlipsick. The government told the jury that if Andrew hadn't heard police sirens approaching the house, he would have raped Jamie. Considering her skirt was removed, not ripped, during the attack, and the fact that he had already shown sexual aggression towards her, this is a logical conclusion. I also think back to the autopsy findings of the incised, protracted wound on her back. I said before, it seemed like an attempt to further terrorize Jamie. Thankfully, he was scared off by the sirens, so Jamie didn't suffer the further degradation of rape. The government called 14 friends and family members of the victims to give impact statements. A psychologist even evaluated the friends and family and testified. He said they suffered from mental health issues ranging from bereavement and anxiety disorder to major depression, depressive disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Losing a beautiful young couple, just 24 and 25 years old, was simply devastating. Jamie's sister would later say, "It's not like it was a car accident. They were traumatized knowing the brutality of what Jamie and Andy went through." The government also had 5 people testify about Andrew's lack of remorse. Evidently, he acted rather callously in front of friends and law enforcement after the murders. Also, Jason King's surgeon testified about Jason's injuries, surgeries, and the aftermath of his suffering due to these grievous injuries. The defense needed to prove the attacks were not premeditated. They blamed it on adrenaline, which was brought on by anger, fueled by alcohol that was coursing through Andrew Witt's body. The defense insisted this caused his cognitive functions to be impaired. The defense had a much harder job than the government, especially in light of Andrew's confession. They didn't have many people they could call to testify, not like the dozens who testified for the government. They called a doctor to the stand to testify about physiological and psychological effects of stress, adrenaline, and alcohol on perception and memory. They also called Dr. B.M., Andrew's first forensic psychologist, to the stand to testify about the effects of adrenaline. Dr. B.M. testified about the physiology of fight or flight and the cognitive effects of stress-induced release of adrenaline into the body. He said, quote, "These adrenal gland releases can impair cognitive functions that guide behavior, thoughts, feelings, impulse control, judgment, decision-making, and insight." During the hearing, Dr. B.M. underwent direct examination by the defense. When the defense asked Dr. BM about Andrew's diagnosis, Dr. BM stated that Andrew had schizoid and borderline traits, which is not what he had previously told the defense team. He had originally diagnosed Andrew with paranoid, not schizoid traits. I am not totally comfortable trying to explain the difference in those diagnoses, except that from what I have read, in general, it is the paranoid type that tends to be more physically aggressive, which would be an important distinction for the defense. They could posit that Andrew was not naturally aggressive. It was the adrenaline from the arguments. It was the booze. Andrew Witt is not an evil man. But in this situation, I don't think that is the right context. Their expert doctor really screwed up by saying schizoid on the stand, because that diagnosis would tend to show Andrew would not have mental health issues with violent traits that may have caused his actions that night. An expert testifying to diagnosed mental health issues is more powerful than blaming anger and alcohol. People get drunk and mad all the time. Most don't brutally stab three people. During cross-examination, Dr. BM was forced to admit that he had incorrectly testified during the direct examination. He said the correct diagnosis was paranoid and borderline traits. Because of the doctor's error, the government asked for an independent psychological evaluation of Andrew. Andrew agreed to undergo the independent evaluation, but the government and defense settled on letting the government's expert witness, Dr. CR and court records, conduct the evaluation rather than find an independent doctor. This is another crucial error made by Andrew Witt's defense team, especially since the government's expert, Dr. CR, testified that Andrew had, quote, no difficulty in the areas of controlling anger, rage, or impulsivity. Furthermore, Andrew had been fully able to recount his actions that night, including his motivations and planning. This is not consistent with cognitive impairment. Based on the court records, it does not seem that this doctor was concerned with the terminology of schizoid or paranoid, because he did not believe that Andrew suffered from either personality disorder. And he also insisted that Andrew did not suffer from a traumatic brain injury. His conclusion was devastating for the defense. Quote, Andrew Witt had a logical sequencing of behavior to accomplish his goals and abstract reasoning. The defense knew they could not recall Dr. BM to the stand to talk about Andrew's psychological evaluation because he had already screwed up and been discredited, so the jury might not believe his testimony. The defense team had time to ask for a continuance to find a forensic psychologist to replace Dr. BM as their expert witness, but they did not ask. Another mistake. And then basically, without expert testimony to refute Dr. CR, the defense's whole case fell apart. The defense had Andrew's roommate testify about the voicemail he had received from Andy, but they did not call anyone to the stand who could talk about Andrew as a person. There was no one willing to get on stand to counter the evil guy argument the government presented. The 12-panel jury of officers deliberated for about 12 hours over the course of 3 days, and they found Andrew Witt guilty, unanimously. Because the vote was unanimous, Andrew was eligible for the death penalty. A unanimous vote is required for a death sentence to be even considered during the penalty phase in a court-martial. Before his sentencing, Andrew said, quote, to the families, to the Schlipsicks and Bielenbergs, I am so sorry from the bottom of my being. I'm so sorry I took your son and your daughter away from you, and also to Mr. King, I'm so sorry for hurting you. He also submitted a written statement that read, I would like to apologize again to the Schlipsicks, the Bielenbergs, the Kings, my family, and the Air Force for my actions. My life has changed dramatically since that night, and I plan to continue to make changes. I want you to know that I am firmly resolved to lead a productive life in the service of others and will not wander from this path if given the chance. Please allow me to live so that I can do this. He went on in the letter writing, Thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my thoughts with you. I regret losing my focus on the Air Force mission. Looking back, I do truly love the Air Force, and I have been proud to wear the uniform. I understand that my actions mean I will never wear it again once this trial is over, and I am sorry for that as well. I am sorry for the discredit I have brought upon the Air Force and the negative attention I have brought to Robins Air Force Base. On April 13, 2005, Andrew was dishonorably discharged, which was automatic because he had been sentenced to death. His pleas for mercy made no difference. He was the first airman to be given a death sentence since 1992, when Jose Samoy was sentenced to death after he was convicted of robbing a bank and killing a police officer. The last U.S. military execution carried out was in 1961, when Army Private John Bennett was hanged. He had been convicted of the rape and attempted murder of an 11-year-old girl. The president has to confirm the death penalty before a member of the military can be executed. According to an article by Nancy Montgomery for Stars and Stripes written just 10 days ago, federal death row holds about 60 prisoners right now. The last executions were during the Bush administration in the early 2000s, when the Oklahoma City bomber, Timothy McVeigh, was executed. And this was after a 40-year hiatus. The point of Ms. Montgomery's article is that the current presidential administration has plans to reinstate federal executions, though so far, none have been carried out. The president seems more interested in giving clemency to members of the military who committed war crimes. Regardless, just as in civilian court, there is an automatic appeals process for court-martials as well. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is the highest court, but this court only reviews questions of law, and their decisions can be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Andrew appealed his conviction and sentencing on 88 issues. Oral arguments were held in October 2012. In August 2013, the Court of Criminal Appeals found three issues where the defense didn't look into mitigating evidence. Had the jury known about these three issues, they may have made a different verdict. Had even one person found Andrew not guilty of premeditation, he wouldn't have been eligible for the death penalty. The first issue regarded the possible traumatic brain injury Andrew suffered from the motorcycle accident. In his appeal, Andrew submitted information provided by yet another doctor that said, quote, "With proper scanning, he could have found out whether Andrew had suffered a brain injury." He also stated that Andrew's behavior was consistent with a traumatic brain injury, though he could not be sure without seeing a brain scan. The second issue regarded Andrew's mother's mental health history. The defense failed to, quote, "investigate the appellant's family history of mental disorder." After their esteemed forensic psychologist, Dr. BM, who screwed up his testimony at trial, told them that they didn't need his mother's medical records, the defense should have requested them anyway. Quote, "They cannot simply hire an expert and then abandon all further responsibility. It is the attorney who bears the responsibility to investigate and bring to the attention of mental health experts who are examining his clients facts that the experts do not request." The third issue had to do with the defense not investigating the testimony from that deputy sheriff regarding Andrew's breakdown at the pretrial hearing. The defense did not ask the deputy sheriff if he would be willing to take the stand and testify to what happened at the pretrial hearing. When contacted by the Criminal Court of Appeals, the deputy sheriff said that he would have testified. The appeals court affirmed Andrew's conviction, but they set aside the sentence and ordered a rehearing to be performed by the judge advocate general. However, four judges did not participate in this appeal decision because they arrived after oral arguments began. The government immediately appealed this ruling, asking the CCA to reconsider setting aside Andrew Witt's death sentence. In October 2013, the Criminal Court of Appeals reconsidered and found that the defense was not incompetent on the three issues, and they upheld the death sentence. The reconsideration included judgments from three of the four judges who didn't participate in the original appeal decision. So now, Andrew Witt appealed the reconsideration because it was wrong for those three judges to participate in the reconsideration when they did not participate in Witt's original appeal. This would be the three of the four judges who didn't show up until after oral arguments began. And on we go. Needless to say, Jamie and Andy's families were devastated by the hearing for a new sentencing almost 10 years after the murders. There is a Facebook page dedicated to a memorial fund for Jamie and Andy, and on there is a very moving video by Jamie's sister Jody. You can also find it on YouTube. Her family wanted his death sentence upheld. She talks about how this appeals process further traumatized their family. It is a gut-wrenching video to watch. On July 19, 2016, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, the highest military court, ordered a new sentencing hearing because they found the Criminal Court of Appeals had mishandled Andrew's original appeal by allowing the participation of those three judges in the reconsideration. On July 6, 2018, Andrew was resentenced to life in prison, just as Jody feared. They were put back through this process. I hope now, even though it was not the outcome the families wanted, that they are at peace. There are no more automatic appeals for Andrew Witt. Jason King suffered immensely after surviving the horrific attack. He was promoted to staff sergeant while still in the hospital, and he has always told reporters how much support he received from the Air Force during this difficult time. But that doesn't stop the nightmares, and it didn't stop the debilitating PTSD he suffers from. Jason tried to recover. He went to Airman Leadership School and also served in Korea. He officially retired from the Air Force in 2011 after he was diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, a breathing condition most likely caused by the scarring on his lungs from the brutal attack. He also started drinking excessively and became addicted to painkillers. And sadly, his marriage to Paige buckled under the pressures of this tragedy and Jason's continued suffering. The couple divorced in 2009. And perhaps the saddest part, Jason felt tremendous guilt for running out the door that night, though he was running for help. He hoped that by running for help, the sirens drove Andrew Witt out of the house before he could rape Jamie. But he could not help but feel like he let his friends down and that by running, he was a coward. This is not true. Andy's call to 911 was only 34 seconds, and it was from a cell phone, not quickly traced if Andy didn't get his address out, which he didn't. If Jason hadn't run for help, I don't believe the cops would have gotten there that quickly. To me, Jason King is a hero. After his retirement, Jason King moved home to Johnson City, Tennessee, and got sober. He worked for a while at the post office, but had trouble with the job physically due to his lasting injuries. He told the Air Force Times in 2013, quote, "I couldn't physically lift things, and I couldn't mentally do it. It was just too much too soon, I guess." He had to fight for disability and won, but he felt conflicted about this. Quote, "I don't like it. I don't like being one of those guys living off the system. I don't want to be inside, jobless, being a piece of trash." But as he said, he has to live. This interview was in 2013, and I truly hope Jason King doesn't feel like trash for being on disability now. And though he will probably always feel guilty for running that night, he ended the interview in a very positive way. Quote, "The message I want to get out there is that in your darkest hour, when horrible things happen to you, when you're facing life or death, there is always hope. If it helps even one person, then to me, it was worth it. Maybe this is the reason why I survived." As for Andrew Witt and his resentencing, I believe it was technically fair. His court-martial, appeal, and reconsiderations were messy, not just by his defense team, but by the Court of Criminal Appeals' decision to let those judges participate who hadn't bothered to show up for oral arguments. Yet it does seem strange to me that two doctors insisted he had no traumatic brain injury, but 10 years later, they found an expert who said he did. No, Andrew Witt did not have a history of violence before the early morning hours after the 4th of July on Robins Air Force Base in 2004. But after several arguments and threats to his career, he had the wherewithal to change into camouflage fatigues, arm himself with a combat knife, and then silently stalk his prey. This is what is called a cooling-off period. He had time to change his mind. He made a choice. Andrew Witt forced his way into a home and brutally stabbed 3 people with a combat knife, killing a young couple in the prime of their lives and leaving their friend traumatized and permanently disabled. I do believe it was premeditated. He knew exactly what he was doing. And he ruined so many lives, including his own, with this selfish, monstrous act. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to Haley Gray for her diligent research on this case. And thank you to listeners Kelly and Elena Coates for suggesting this case. Y'all, the live show with Alicia and Stacy from Trashy Divorces is this weekend. Our Scattered, Covered, and Smothered tour will be in Atlanta this Sunday at Vinkman's, and the doors open at 5 p.m. I've got a link to buy tickets in the show notes. There will be a Southern-inspired menu for the evening, different types of seating for different tiers, and a meet-and-greet for VIP guests that you can also add onto any other ticket. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Spotify, Stitcher, and most other podcatchers. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Private messages on social media often get lost, so email is best. And please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.